Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Not even a life-altering explosion can stop a hero during difficult times. Attend the opening ceremony at Firehouse World in February 2011 to hear Marine Corporal Joshua Blyle share about a bombing in Iraq that took both his legs. You'll leave motivated to face whatever challenges may come your way when you're out on your next call. Get complete details at firehouseworld.com.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. Recording this on a somewhat chilly December, so unless you're down in the southern part of our fine country, which even down in Florida, they were expecting some cold weather. Between where Brother Mike's located and I am in different parts of the state, and today we are very fortunate to have with us a guest, Mr. Keith Purdy. Keith is president of Plastisol North America, and Keith's resume is quite lengthy and detailed, including a long stint with Salisbury Fire Apparatus, which was located in Tully, New York, as well as being a regional manager with American LaFrance. And Keith has a great background in apparatus design, specifically with respect to body construction, and that's going to be a part of our discussion. So welcome, Keith, to the program.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, here's the rundown. We're going to do, Brother Wilbur's going to start off with just a couple short segments of one or two of the most more notable incidents that have happened since we last recorded a podcast, and then we're going to jump right into a myriad of questions with Keith to talk about the body design and construction and some tips of what different departments may be doing to look for when they go to develop specifications for their next rig. So having said that, Brother Wilbur, what's been hot on the news wire here lately?
A lot of stuff, Brother Tom, that you just can't believe. A driver was responsible for a line-of-duty death in Columbia, Richmond, South Carolina. The firefighter that was killed was Chance Hyatt Zabel. Chance Hyatt Zabel has been charged. Cops charged 34-year-old Nita Ortega with driving too fast for conditions and killed firefighter Zabel. She only had a Mexican driver's license, but no other license, and they're looking to see if she is actually here legally. Firefighter Zabel, 23, was killed as he operated along the highway at a brush fire, and the impaired driver ended up hitting the back of a vehicle and killed firefighter Zabel in that unfortunate incident. Moving on, another drunk kills a highway responder. And again, we just have to caution our listeners. It's just extremely dangerous, particularly this time of year with all the Christmas parties and holiday hoopla, to be operating along the nation's highways. A veteran Caltrans employee was killed over the weekend after a drunk driver struck and killed him near the scene of another fatal accident in Chico, California. Gary Smith, 57, was helping to set up traffic to block for CHP on the northbound lanes of Highway 99 after another fatal DUI crash, and a man by the name of Russell Hodge, 45, drove his pickup truck right through the closure and slammed right into Mr. Smith, fatally injuring him. The drunk Hodge continued driving down Highway 99, but was stopped by CHP officers a short distance down the road. CHP determined that Mr. Hodge was under the influence and arrested him. And it should be noted that Hodge had been convicted 3 times of driving under the influence in the past 10 years. He's now facing murder charges. A Texas apparatus rolled over late last month in San Antonio. A firefighter was hospitalized after he was trapped inside when the aerial ladder he was driving lost control while responding to a building fire. The firefighter that was trapped and injured was actually in the back seat of ladder 35, which rolled while taking a turn It took officials about an hour to free him from the wreckage. His injuries are thought to be non-life-threatening as we went to record this podcast. A Canadian firefighter was fined in a fatal collision. A Vaughan firefighter has been fined after a February crash killed another driver. Vaughan pleaded guilty to failing to stop at a red light February 2nd. He was fined $500 by a justice of the peace. Emergency crews had been called to Major McKenzie Drive and Highway 400 area February 2nd at about 10:35 a.m. after an eastbound Vaughan fire truck collided with a Toyota Camry driven by a 54-year-old Vaughan man in the intersection of the exit ramp northbound to Highway 400. The impact caused the Camry to spin and slam into a light pole. The fire truck was on its way to a call when the vehicles collided. The Camry driver was pronounced dead at the hospital, and four other firefighters were injured. And then finally, it just seems like this could probably be a poster for the sign of the times. In Allegheny, firefighters across the Alleghenies have been battling blazes this past week, but also they had to make some difficult decisions during these rough economic times, such as the West Hills Regional Fire Department in Cambry County in Pennsylvania. It's been several months since the crew sent their ladder truck away to be furbished at a cost of about $250,000. It would have cost more than $1 million to buy a new one, and financial-wise, they just couldn't think about swinging to buy a new ladder truck, Chief Donald Blasco said, but the refurbishment entailed everything from a new paint job to having the ladder removed, including upgrades such as new safety features required by the state, new LED lighting, and new signals to protect vehicles following the trucks. Again, it just seems, Brother Tom, like this is probably going to continue, and it's just a sign of the times.
No doubt, Mike. And just a quick question and comment. I heard the other day while listening to some radio traffic, this had to do with what you were just talking about shutting down the highway or securing the highway. And I was listening to some radio traffic in an upstate New York county where, you know, they were undergoing a, you know, little mini blast of snow. And I heard a chief officer instruct one of the firefighters to utilize his POV to block the road until such time that the police could get there to secure the highway. Any brief comment or experience on that? What liability or exposure does somebody have when you start using your own personal vehicle at the scene of an emergency to kind of like act as an emergency vehicle of sorts?
The rules are fairly clear. It goes back to who actually insures the vehicle. And by the chief ordering that particular firefighter to use his own personal vehicle block the highway, if something were to happen there, it would have been that firefighter's personal or auto insurance that would have had to taken up the case. And then as the vehicle was being used more like an emergency vehicle than a regular car, and we know that it costs more to insure emergency vehicles than a regular car. You wonder if this particular firefighter, if an incident were to occur, would have had insurance next year from that company. We know that insurance companies can, they have a 2% rule where they can actually just refuse without giving any reason to insure 2% of their insureds. And it even begs another question, and that's volunteer fire chiefs that decide to put red lights and a siren on their cars. And it's all fun and games going out and playing fire chief until somebody hits your car or you hit somebody or something happens to it. At 3 o'clock in the morning, it's a poor time to figure out who's actually going to pay and who's going to be held liable in the case of an incident or an accident. And what I find even more bizarre as I go around are volunteer fire chiefs who decide to put red lights and sirens on company vehicles that they own. So basically, when they turn on those red lights and sirens, they're not only screaming, sue me, and take my house, but now sue me, you not only can take my house, but you could potentially take my business as well. So without having all the facts, but just what you said, it appears to be a very poor choice by the fire chief. And although the fire chief was, I guess, commandeering the car to be used in this purpose, one could stretch it and say that the fire department could somehow be responsible, but generally that firefighter's personal insurance would have to kick in first, and then the fire department would come next.
All right, so thanks for that, Michael. Well, we appreciate the Keith's patience here while we banter around on some of the most recent incidents. So we're going to get into the formal part of the program here, talking about body design and construction, and one of Keith's other accolades during his tenure in the current tenure in the apparatus industry is he served as the marketing and the national sales manager for several other companies, and again has just a great experience in dealing with a myriad of different departments coast to coast in working with them to try to get apparatus designed to cost effectively and to meet the department's needs. So with that, Keith, given today's, quote, modern fire trucker, where we are here in 2010, if your department is looking to buy a pumper or something along the lines of what we would call a typical, Class A triple combination unit, give us your perception in terms of what body materials are out there and how they might kind of fit individual departments' needs, what the market segment might be looking at to help with whatever we can build a fire truck body out of today.
I will respond to your question, Tom, and for those that are not familiar with listening to my responses, you may want to get a roadmap out now because I'm going to wander all over the place on this question.
All right, well, please keep in mind, Keith, that much like some other very important, but not like us, nationally syndicated shows, we're trying to get a couple of questions in, and we need to try to fit this in within like 60 to 65 minutes. So if you're going to take 68 minutes to do this, you might want to, as they would say, let's just cut to the chase and let's have no spin here.
Okay, well, we can do that then. The condensed version is most customers are coming into the market typically are told by the apparatus manufacturer what body materials are available to them. In the traditional sense of that activity, which you were making mention to, a customer arrives looking for one of the traditional products that the major manufacturers offer, pumper, aerial, quint, whatever. In that, the manufacturer's probably predetermined a choice or a product material and will then try to convey or convince to the customer that the material that's been pre-selected for them is in fact the solution to their needs. The reality of this, which is an economic reality, often those larger manufacturers have committed to one or two material products in their inventory. That is what they stock, and therefore that is what they offer.
All right, well then, cut to the chase here. Specifically, not talking about construction now, but what, if you had a manufacturer that had two or three different, options for what they offer, what can a customer typically expect, an apparatus salesperson to lead off and say, you want to consider this type of body material?
In terms of sales in North America, most customers are going to see their contact indicate aluminum as a product choice for an apparatus body. They may see some interest depending on climate and environment for stainless steel. There are some pockets, and we do see some customers that are still buying steel or are interested in galvanized steel or a steel product that is coated against environmental degradation in some way. There are some, and it's a small part of the market, there are some customers that are buying, in fact, the company that I'm with right now, we are doing non-metal bodies, and we do have a market for those bodies. It's a small portion of the market. It's definitely not mainstream. There are some reasons to explore those types of materials. But by and large, for most buyers in the central part of the market, they're going to see aluminum and stainless steel, Tom.
All right. So with that being said, again, talking now specifically, Keith, and Mike, with the pumper portion of the product lines, any particular, call it, you know, disadvantages or pros and cons that you would see of each of those two materials? If a customer is trying to weigh, before they get to any kind of financial implications, one versus the other, what do you see are typical or mainstream arguments for or against those two types of material?
In the world of the aluminums, and I split aluminum into two different product families, there are those folks that are doing extruded aluminum construction where they are taking a piece of extruded material. They're putting in panel pieces of aluminum and bringing those two pieces together to form the structure of their body. Then there's aluminum manufacturers that are bending the material and forming it up in a much more traditional style of construction. The practical applications for the extruded aluminum design is really one of economic sense. Extrusions and extruded manufacturing was an attempt to draw labor hours and therefore purchase price down and away from consumers to have a product that was more affordable. Stainless customers, switching now, Tom, to stainless steel, someone who's interested in stainless steel is looking at that product for its environmental capabilities. In other words, locations where we're going to see liquid salt being put down on the roads, magnesium chloride, calcium chloride, where we're going to use some sort of product that will eat at some of the metals that are available, stainless steel is going to look like a practical solution because it will take away some of the threat of corrosion in those environments.
Okay. With that then, Keith, it seems to me that one of the arguments that I have heard argued pretty persuasively in the past of aluminum versus stainless steel was that the people promoting an aluminum product, and again, we're talking about body construction now, because when you get to cab construction, that's an entirely different venue. That people would, a salesperson I've heard rather vehemently argue the point that aluminum was a more preferable material to use versus the stainless steel because of a weight factor, implying that they could carry more weight, equipment weight, or could carry more hose, or put a bigger booster tank on their vehicle, everything else being equal, of playing the one material versus the other. How would you respond to that, or what do you think, what's the viability of that argument or discussion?
On the surface, looking at the material itself, I would agree that anyone who is weighing that argument in their own mind, aluminum is clearly a lighter material than steel or stainless steel. That being said, if you, as a committee, are looking at the way that the total apparatus body is constructed, often you will find a wide variance between manufacturers of the substructure that is sitting between the chassis frame rails and whatever is supporting the body that you are looking at. In many cases, that substructure may in fact be steel, even on an aluminum body. And what we see is, while the surface material, panel per panel, may appear to be lighter in the world of aluminum, the practical reality of a finished apparatus, a stainless steel body may be disturbingly close in terms of total weight to an aluminum body with a steel understructure.
I have a question, Keith. What about a customer that would come to you and say, well, because of the weight, I'd like to have the aluminum, but I'm not sure how it's going to hold up on the road salt. Some salespeople make a claim that aluminum doesn't rust, but doesn't it pit or chalk out?
Absolutely. Any metal that you use is going to see some reaction to a chemical that's applied to it. The question becomes one of duration and what you're willing to live with. I've had some experience in the ambulance world. I don't profess to be an ambulance expert, but I am quite familiar in the northeast of the United States seeing ambulances where the back panel has corroded and we see exfoliation, the application of some chemical solvent getting between the aluminums or getting between paint and primer, and eventually powdering out and causing expansion or causing degradation of the body. And that is quite common, probably not as common as what you would see with rust on steel, because rust tends to leave a mark and a stain, whereas the aluminum during the process of exfoliation does leave a white powder, which can be quite easily taken care of.
So Keith, let's leveraging off of Mike's question and in your earlier comments, how and where do you find out, beyond the obvious of asking the question, when somebody starts talking about, a salesperson starts talking about their body material and focuses in on, as I would call it, the parent material, the part that you see from when you're standing up and looking into a compartment, this is what I see. How do you find out and determine exactly how the body is mounted and what that substructure is made out of?
A very, very intriguing question. Many committees who are evaluating how they're going to do their body become endlessly fascinated with a warranty. And there is a perception in the market that the warranty that is offered by the body manufacturer somehow is a gauge into the lifespan or expected lifespan of the product. The reality, which is disturbing even on the surface, is many warranties offered today are longer periods of time than the agency that's building the body in terms of them being in business. So these bold promises of long warranties, often there's no track record from the manufacturer that that body's been in existence for the time period they're promising. For any committee, looking and evaluating what they're going to do and what makes sense for their department is one of getting underneath the vehicle and looking at the materials that are subject to the corrosion that will be present in their environment, seeing what those materials are and evaluating if the materials chosen by that manufacturer are consistent with the lifespan they're seeking to achieve. Big words, the simple reality, you buy the best you can get for the money that you want to spend. I have met many customers in my time who are willing to buy a vehicle that they're only planning on keeping for a couple years. And in that evaluation, it's purely price. Anyone who's keeping a vehicle longer, and many committees are, really need to sit down, get beyond the brand names, and get into what the material actually is and how it's put together.
Two really good points here that I'd like to amplify on. When you mentioned about the warranties, just like rephrase that so for the purposes of our listeners, and not to beat up on, this not mean meant to demean companies that are new in the apparatus marketplace, or for those, to reiterate, you know, what Keith said, you know, somebody's offering a 20-year structural warranty on the body, and this company may very well build good apparatus, but they've been in business for 10 or 12 years. Well, you can't, as Keith said, you can't go out and find a 20-year-old body built by that company because they weren't in business 20 years ago. To refine that point one step further, specifically with body warranties, kind of applicable to any kind of warranty that where somebody just makes the broad brush statement, for example, we have a 20-year structural warranty on our body. We have a 10-year paint warranty. That's all fine and good. What you need to do is then ask the prospective bidder. Certainly you want to require this with your bid package, but if you're trying to evaluate, as Keith mentioned, what your dollar is going to buy here, ask for a copy of the specific warranty, statement of warranty, where it's just not going to read two lines and say, we, fill in the blank, you know, company shall warrant our body for 20 years for all structural defects, period. These go on for at least one page, in some cases two sides of an 8.5 by 11 sheet that typically has qualifiers at the bottom that can be anywhere from one, I've seen as many as 10 qualifiers. And when you talk about a structural warranty, it generally is the body shell itself minus anything that bolts or attaches to it. And when you read some of the warranties, it states it's like a rust-through warranty. It doesn't cover anything, including sometimes cracks, deformation of the body. It may or may not. But if somebody just says the blanket statement, again, amplify on Keith's point, if Keith and I are competing and Keith's company offers a 10-year warranty and my company offers a 20-year warranty, that does not mean that the Tom Shand body is twice as good as Keith's, because I could have all kinds of exclusions in that statement of warranty for things that Keith's company may very well cover. So to that point, Keith, I think a very, very good point. And the second thing, talk a little bit more about life cycle with respect to this. Mike and I have done some work, fleet management studies, for some good-sized fire departments where they were considering doing lease purchase of apparatus to the point where, whether it was 5 years, 7 year, or 8 year, they were just going to run that vehicle for that period of time, simply turn it back to the manufacturer, and then go out and exercise an option to buy an improved version of the same thing from the same guy, or to go someplace else. So if somebody's in the marketplace and they're looking to have a life cycle expectancy on a major piece of apparatus of 5 to 8 years, what recommendations would you have for people that are in the marketplace and looking to do something like that?
In my world, Tom, and in many of the customers that I visit with, often I find out that, and this is for your listeners, this is an opinion that is not meant to pit one side of one of your respected committees against the other side of your committee. What I'm seeing, and I see this quite clearly, is there's a perception in North America, specifically in the United States fire apparatus market, that whatever we owned previously, our next vehicle must be larger. Either the engine output horsepower, the booster tank size, the fire pump capacity, whatever it is, or in many cases, every aspect of the previous vehicle must be made larger simply because it's the new vehicle. And what I'm seeing is, and perhaps I'm all wet in this, but given today's weather, as you previously mentioned, maybe I'm not, I'm noticing that we are quickly creating $600,000 taxicabs. And they are run for 5 to 8 years as brutally as possible to carry a crew from point A to point B, most often, especially in some environments, not involved in direct fire suppression. So to get back to your question, to really try to answer it, at an ordinary life cycle, the questions are, what is this product supposed to do, and what are its priorities? Once they're defined, what you own today may not be consistent with what you need to buy this time around. And there are many customers that approach the market with a, diesel engines are cheap, big water is cheap, big pumps in North America are exceptionally inexpensive compared to the rest of the world, and we're blessed with some pretty strong water systems in most municipalities. We use big water, and we tend to buy big vehicles, but keeping those products in service for a length of time is a bit of a challenge.
Keith, a very good point. Mike and I have spoken in the past about incremental purchasing, and while we're not here to knock, again, any particular component suppliers to people who build apparatus in the States, it's not uncommon in a lot of geographic areas to find the 550 horsepower, 2250 GPM pumper with 18 discharges, dual deck guns, and virtually everything conceivable that they could jam on a vehicle and still make it fit in 34 feet. And it goes to your point, when we broke the $500,000 mark for pumpers, I sincerely thought, I think Mike did tell, that, some reality's got to, in fact, Mike has often said, when do people stop putting stuff on a rig? When it either doesn't fit the firehouse or they run out of money. And that's really kind of like no way to design a fire truck, but it goes to your point very significantly. So before we go to break, summarize what we've talked about so far. A lot of what you want to consider in your body is going to depend upon what life cycle expectancy you look to get out of the rig. A lot of it's got to do with look out the window and see what kind of climatic conditions that you deal with. If you're down in the desert southwest, you may or may not need a stainless steel body. If you're up in the area where Tom and Mike, Keith, or where Peter hails from, you want to look at what they throw down on the road, and that stuff is going to destroy your rig and can have a direct impact on the life cycle that you may be expecting. When we come back from the break, we're going to put Keith on the spot and talk a little bit more about body construction, but specifically what kind of equipment should you be carrying and what kind of equipment do we find people wanting to be placing on apparatus today, and all of that's got an impact on how big the vehicle is and what kind of costs we're looking at. So with that, you've got the apparatus architects, Mike Rover, Tom Shand, and our guest this month, Keith Purdy. We'll be right back.
The best way to learn a new skill or improve upon one you already have is to actually put it into practice. Choose from 6 hands-on training classes at Firehouse World 2011 in San Diego this coming February. Classes include trench rescue, firefighter survival, air management, extrication, and more. Learn by doing. Complete details available at firehouseworld.com.
Hey, we're back. Apparatus architects Mike Wilbur, Tom Shand, and our guest this month, Keith Purdy from Plastisol Composites North America. So I know, Mike, you've got a reflection and a couple of questions that you'd like to throw at Keith. Go have at it.
Okay, well, the first one, Thomas, is did, Keith came really close to one of our favorite topics of discussion. When a committee sets out to design a truck, is to define the mission of the vehicle. What's it going to carry? What's it going to be like? And, of course, we all know that as much as we'd like to have a pumper, ladder, rescue, light truck, tanker, ARF, brush truck all in one, that it becomes extremely expensive and impractical and probably wouldn't work very good in most jurisdictions. And then as I teach, particularly the ladder course, and we talk about Quint apparatus, and the department has 5 pumpers and they want to put a pump on their ladder, and yet we ask them how many times they use portable ladders versus the aerial device themselves, and you get comments like 5-to-1 and 8-to-1, and then you realize that a pump and a tank could actually take away from the sole mission or the central mission of the vehicle, which is to carry portable ladders. And Keith, we kind of hinted at it just before the break there, so can you kind of expand on that?
Absolutely. One of the things that I see quite frequently, and again, for the listeners to have a clear picture of this, I differentiate. There are fire apparatus consultants who study design, who are intuitive, creative, and also have a capacity for listening. And then there's a second market, which are fire apparatus sales agents. Their mission is to move product, statistically grow market share, and follow a set of rules and abide by a set of rules that largely follow the automotive industry. If your committee is out to purchase a product, it stands to reason that you define the product as clearly and completely as you can. It is very difficult in this industry to create a multi-mission machine that achieves all goals and expectation without issue. Even with the larger chassis that we're seeing today, and I forgot to mention during the first part of the show, in my own evaluation, it seems to me that in the last 15 years, we have seen a growth of the axle capacity and horsepower capacity of ordinary pumpers grow by as much as 25%. In that, the market is indicating that customers are buying much larger vehicles which are capable of carrying significantly more of something. What that something is may be equipment, maybe water, maybe a pump, maybe a compressed air foam system, maybe an aerial, who knows. But customers are buying bigger vehicles. In that, they're trying to pack more into these vehicles, but they're not truly achieving, in many cases, fire ground efficiency gains. And this is where sometimes the fire department goes sideways. If you're not studying how your team deploys, and if you're not sure that what you're doing today is safe, you may want to slow down versus buying a bigger version of the mistakes you're presently making.
Pete, very, very well put. I think we probably need to take, if you have a guardian angel version of you, take you out on the road with that, because that goes again to amplify on Mike's point. Bigger is not always better, and if you're not doing a good job, you're dissatisfied. It's one of the first questions Mike and I will intuitively ask folks is tell us what you like, and more importantly, maybe what you don't like and what you'd like to change on your existing apparatus. And a lot of times you won't get a valid response to that question, but you will then automatically get 6 replies that indicate that they wanted more horsepower, more seating. You know, they want a raised roof this time. We got to put on some type of foam system because we don't have it and everybody else around us has got it. And pretty soon in the ensuing minute and 30 seconds, they just spent another $80,000 or $100,000 and made the vehicle 3 foot longer, but nobody really seems to care at that point.
Absolutely.
With respect to the equipment packaging, Keith, what type of advice would you give to a department, or when you come in and work with a department? I know a lot of what you do with your composite bodies are the smaller types of initial attack vehicles or like a first response, you know, EMS unit, but it doesn't make any difference whether you're talking about something slightly bigger than a pickup or something that you're going to fill up, you know, every inch of your 48-foot bay with. You know, how do you address and get people to understand how they need to discern, once they define the mission of the vehicle, what the equipment packaging and the respective impact that's going to have on axle loadings on the vehicle?
I'm glad you asked, Tom. There is a litmus test question that I ask all of our customers, and that is, by the time you're finished, when you have written your bid document or your purchasing specification document, the litmus test of success is you should have more pages of your specification devoted to explaining the equipment you inventory and more pages explaining how you perform than you should have pages explaining how you want the manufacturer to paint, bolt, or put graphics on the side of your new vehicle. Emphasis must be placed on equipment, that this is in fact a toolbox. It happens to make noise at about 125 decibels, and it certainly has enough lights to bring down a 737 at 30,000 feet, thinking that it's a landing pad. But the reality is, when you get on scene, the vehicle must perform. For us, packaging is, please describe everything you want to carry, put that into the specification, make sure it's noted, take the burden of loading and mounting and give that to the manufacturer. That's the speciality that must be thrust from the customer to the manufacturer, because only then is there any sort of possible explanation and possible depth to the design to make sure that the end-use product, when fully loaded, will actually function in accordance with the GVW requirements, braking requirements, NFPA requirements, and safe mounting. There is a just amazing amount of unsafe equipment mounting going on. One of my favorites, and I know, Tom, you've heard me say it before, my favorite is the term coffin compartment. It's given that name for a very specific reason. If you need to put something 11 feet in the air and carry it on that vehicle, chances are you probably move your personal vehicle at home, park it in your driveway, lift it with a crane, and put it on the attic of your house because you need to put things up high so you know where they are.
Keith, I can't compliment you enough on your how you're hitting the ball out of the park here, but we're going to put you on a spot here momentarily. I'm your friendly apparatus salesman, or as Mike said many years ago, I'm the guy trying to take as much money out of your pocket and put it in mine. And I'm working with Chief Wilbur, who has decided, for whatever godforsaken reason, he wants a single axle quint. Again, we're not here to talk about that, dash that subject, but Chief Wilbur's decided he's got to have one. So I go in and I meet with Chief Wilbur and I say, okay, you got a pumper, you've got no ladder truck, and help me out here, Chief. How much equipment do you want to carry? And I get a blank stare. If you're trying to whisper into my ear, Keith, what are some of the buzzwords or things that I can do to get the people to move off that center to address this? Because as you said, people now in specifications where you have the required NFPA equipment. This is not everything you're going to carry. This is the small stuff, the nozzles, the extinguishers, the wheel chocks, the adapters, and things like that. There are some manufacturers that for the NFPA 1901 equipment that's required that goes to the total payload capacity, if the fire department is going to supply that, it reads that way in the spec, and then it says fire department supplied. So the burden is off the manufacturer to think that the manufacturer was going to supply that. And that can go on, as you mentioned, Keith, that can go on for 4 or 5 pages if the fire department's not supplying all of that stuff. So what do we do to get help for the department that wants to do the Quint or wants to do the rescue engine, and all they just say is, as I've heard, and Mike has as well, we normally have to scrape them up off the floor. What's the biggest body you make? You know, whenever I hear that, I know we're really in trouble. If you make a 168-inch body versus a 161, the 168's got to be better. And if you can make the coffin compartments 28 inches deep, because the other guy came in and said his standard depth is 20, I want everything as big as I can. What do you do to get in those people's heads to kind of get the ship right-sized?
In many cases, for me, and I'm going to speak about the idea of the aerial Quint, because it is probably one of the more common products that's out there that carries with it so much misunderstanding. And in many cases, you can keep throwing money at it and probably not get to the solution you were looking for. When we meet a customer, especially in my experience, when I meet a customer and they want an aerial Quint, my questions to them actually take up hours of meeting and corroboration. Because what I'm interested in, is this a ladder company team that is interested in fire suppression capability, or is this a fire suppression team that has suddenly decided that they need an aerial advance into whatever environment they're working in? Those are very, very different approaches to the market, and they're very different approaches to fire ground activities. Buying a big, empty body when the GVW capacity of your chassis is now absolutely consumed with the aerial that you've chosen, having big, empty compartments doesn't help you, because often the apparatus is weighed before going in service or weighed upon the manufacturer shipping the vehicle to the end-user location. But in many cases, there isn't a second weigh-in where the finished apparatus, fully laden with equipment, is double or triple checked against the sticker that's in the cab. And if I buy the biggest body, but I don't have any weight capacity left on that axle, now I'm driving an overweight vehicle thinking that I've done everything properly, but in reality I've designed something that is probably incredibly unsafe, and it's a ticking time bomb until my driver and my administration is speaking to someone, probably an attorney, discussing at what point did you load this thing and at what point did you stop listening to the manufacturer.
Very good point. So, Chief Wilbur, is that kind of help us, you know, a little bit, or are we still going to be in trouble here trying to identify what we want this vehicle to do based on defining the mission?
I think Keith really hit some high points, and it's ironic as we as consultants and Keith as a rep for a manufacturer are really turning from the same page and singing from the same sheet of music. It's hopefully we can get the rest of the fire departments out there to kind of see it that way as well. And then a follow-up to that, I don't know that much about composite bodies. And because your company does those, what are the advantages of me looking into something like this that I know very little about, that for the U.S. market in varying degrees is fairly new?
The newness of GRP in the fire apparatus market is actually both an opportunity and it's a threat. The American Fire Service is exceptionally traditional and really does not adapt or absorb new technology all that quickly. That being said, Mike, many of the products that we presently see out on the highway, for example, every tractor trailer cab you see, happens to have a GRP cowl on the front of that cab. It's a very common product in the automotive industry. Making bodies with this material is really an evolution, and it is a European-style evolution that is coming from a market where many customers required a body or a product that could survive in a salty coastal environment or an industrial chemical environment. This is the evolution of this style fiberglass body. In North America, we see fiberglass bodies typically are accepted in the size of utility bodies and brush trucks. And that has been the evolutionary path in North America, whereas in the rest of the world, fiberglass bodies are, in many cases, the entire apparatus fleet may be fiberglass. Again, many crash trucks, aircraft crash trucks, our vehicles, they are typically made of some composite material or some non-metal material in certain portions. I happen to be president of a company that we make an entire aircraft crash vehicle, and we make both cab and body out of fiberglass. The purpose for that is it is a product that can stay outside, doesn't need to be indoors. It can stay in harsh environments, high ember environments for brush fire use, very cold climates without shrinking or expanding. It permits for many customers a product that can fit into a tough environmental situation, can endure scuffing and damage, and not be subject to environmental degradation.
You know, Keith, it's interesting that you mentioned initially in your response to Mike the part about the American Fire Service being traditional. And to that point, for our listeners, if your segue into the fire service in general or anything in particular to what Mike and I have talked about over the years that we've done the podcast and written the Apparatus Architect articles, the tradition of this particular mold that Keith specifically is referring to was initially kind of broken going back into the early 1980s by a company called Young Fire Equipment that was located in kind of my neck of the woods in Lancaster, New York. And they, for a number of years, built very well-constructed steel and, in later years, galvanneal steel bodies. And as a result of feedback that they got and some of the rebuilding work that they were doing at certain points in time for different large metropolitan departments, including at the time Arlington County, Virginia, and the Washington, D.C. Fire Department, they developed with an outside company. They didn't just dream this up and get the equipment themselves, but worked on doing a composite body that actually was modular, where each of the compartments was a different module, and it enjoyed reasonably good success. Unfortunately, due to some financial difficulties that were completely unrelated to that particular product, the company closed its doors for operation during the early 1990s. And I can't help but think, both Keith and Mike, that had Young stayed in business, who was always known as being an innovator and way out in front of the pack, that at some point somebody in the apparatus industry wouldn't have saw what was happening and kind of become a fast follower. Unfortunately, when Young closed their doors and they had proprietary patent rights on some of the designs, they kind of all just, you know, unfortunately fell along the wayside. So here we are. If you think about it, we're almost 25, 30 years later, we're kind of seeing the beginning of this technology once again being accepted, even in some small pocket areas, as Keith alluded to. But Keith, when you mentioned about crash trucks, now that, you know, I was aware of that, but you start thinking about it, people get concerned that they're saying, oh, this body's not, how can it hold up? Because we're the fire service, yet, as you intimated, they're on a lot of Class 7 and 8 trucks that are running up and down the highway all the time and have hundreds of thousands of miles on them, much heavier life cycle and certainly a higher usage factor than anything we could potentially throw at it in the fire service.
In many cases, Tom, where we see fiberglass-style bodies being used are wildland products and off-road applications, either industrial applications or, in many cases, airport operations. And there are some military customers that do this product as well. That gravitation to an off-road-style dependency leads the engineering teams who are creating non-metal bodies to have to support, because there is chassis flex, and there is, in the off-road application, there is a severe service application that must be met. These products lend themselves to that use. You get a specific look. It does look a little different than a metal body. There's no question about that, just by nature of the intrinsic properties of the material that you're putting together. But for many customers, it makes sense. And that is where there's a practical application. And there were, and I believe it to be true, I believe that there were companies doing polypropylene tanks who are also doing polypropylene bodies. That's another non-metal application, and there is a difference between polypropylene and fiberglass. But they also are finding a market. They're finding a location and a customer base that says, I really don't want to deal with metal in this application. This is a long life cycle product. I can re-chassis this product over time. It allows me to buy the right body for my needs, spend time in my equipment load, and then I can replace chassis technology as it becomes available. I can simply lift the body off and put it on another chassis and keep it in service.
Keith, on the re-chassis aspects, any particular experience that you have with that? And I'll just relate an experience that a good-sized fire department had that wasn't using your product but had some small utility composite bodies that they were using on their vehicles on a standardized commercial chassis. They were using the same brand and model. But as they found from a model year change from one year to the other, well, without any upfront information, when they went to re-chassis one of these bodies, they found out that the width over the rear axle had changed without any prior knowledge and had some clearance issues in the with the previously built body that they were going to reinstall. So any particular hints or experiences that you have with that? Because to me, that seems to be very attractive. If something, God forbid, happens and you rack the chassis up, or, you know, just because of your life cycle, if you can get 5 to 7 years out of the chassis, it's hammered and you can reuse the body because the body's in good shape. And any guidelines along there that you can share with the listeners?
Sure. The criteria that we use, and it's a criteria that we try to establish very early in the design, is there are bodies that lend themselves to re-chassing over time. And then there's designs that really probably are not going to be re-chassied. And we're very careful to explain to folks that it's not every customer can re-chassis a product easily. There are some cases where custom cabs, for example, it's not always easy to re-chassis that product depending on the design you do. That being said, there have been many customers that they buy a chassis, and chassis technology has been moving quickly lately. We're seeing the development of electronic traction control systems and ABS systems and anti-rollover protection systems and airbags and you name it, it's coming. And these safety items make sense to a fire administrator. These safety items as an upgrade with a restricted budget, where are you going to put your money? And often you want to put your money, if it is a taxi cab and if you're taking care of your crew, you may want to invest in that new chassis technology. So if you've purchased the right body and you've purchased a body that has a flexible mounting system underneath it, a system that will adapt to a different chassis in time, you're leveraging the investment you made in the body, but you're also investing in new braking technology, safety technology, engineering technology in the crew compartment, which is keeping your team safe. In that, you've made a balance of value versus safety, and in my mind, you're actually coming down on the right side of things. The key is, when you buy that body, you want to make sure that there's flexibility in the mounting design, that it is pre-engineered to adapt different chassis systems so that over time you can, in fact, re-chassis safely.
Very, very, very good and worthwhile points, Keith. Just before we wrap up here, I want to put in a little shameless plug that Mike and Tom will be out at Firehouse World in San Diego, which kicks off on February 26th and goes from the 26th of February through the 3rd of March. We've had the very good fortune and been blessed to go out there for the last couple of years to go put on a few programs that will be doing three different programs and doing a couple of podcasts this year as well. And anytime you can go out to the great city of San Diego and get out of the Northeast in the end of February and beginning of March and get out of snow, it's a great day. So with that, kind of go around the horn here. Keith, any final parting comments or thoughts here before we wrap up?
I will confess to the apparatus architects, having heard the news, as Mike was giving me in the beginning, it's the holiday season, everybody, and it is the season to try to be as safe as possible. And you may think those folks on the highway see you. They're not paying attention to you, unfortunately. It is high time to be as safe as possible, and sometimes that means we get right out of the way and stand to the side of the road. It's the safest place to be.
Very good point, Keith. And with that, we thank you very much for your your insights and your spot-on comments here on the different things for our listeners and potential customers that are going to be working with any type of new apparatus in the future. You're just a great asset, and if people have questions or anything that they would like to have answered in a future podcast, you can send them in the podcast at firehouse.com. Anything specific that they'd like to get a hold and follow up with Keith, send them in there, and we'll make sure that Keith gets those so he can respond back to you directly. And again, we thank Keith very much for his time, and go through the rundown with it today. So, Mike, any final parting thoughts and comments?
Yeah, happy holidays to everybody. And again, I'd like to personally thank Keith. Just really, really tremendous insight, and really has a firm grasp on what the apparatus industry entails. And I just want to pass along my thanks. I have an awful lot of respect for Keith, and it's I think it's well placed. He is really an asset to the apparatus industry.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. And for Tom Shan, for Mike Wilbur, and our guest, Keith Purdy, and best wishes to all the brother and sister firefighters out there and our listeners for a very happy and safe holiday season. And until the next time, we'll see you on the radio. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects. Be well and stay safe.
Firehouse World 2011 is the largest fire service event west of the Mississippi and takes place in San Diego, California, February 26th through March 2nd. Register today at firehouseworld.com and be part of the action. You will have access to over 100 training and educational sessions, 350 exhibitors, plus network with over 7,500 firefighters from around the country. This is one event you don't want to miss.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.